Today is the 20th of August, Sunday. It's about 11:15 a.m. My name is Mark Perez. We are at Hugh Ross's Paradoxes class at 154 West Sierra Madre Boulevard, City of Sierra Madre. I'm saying this for the people who hear this on the internet and know nothing else about this class but what they hear. So with that introduction, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what we're going to be doing today. Decades ago, Hugh Ross started this class as a way of expressing how science and the Bible correlated. In other words, is there a way to show that the Bible is accurate by looking at science? And does science tell us anything other than just scientific facts? And for decades and decades now, at least two decades that I'm aware of, because that's how long, at least how long I've been coming to his classes, we've had all sorts of different ways of looking at science and faith. And what we're going to do today is we're going to look at it from sort of a different perspective. And the title of the class actually today is Science, Rhetoric, and Evangelism, which is an interesting combination of words when you think about any one of those subjects. It's hard to think of science and think about rhetoric at the same time, or evangelism, you might think about rhetoric. But when you think about rhetoric, what is the first thing that pops in your mind? What do you think about when you think of, you hear the word rhetoric?
Please.
Politicians. Yes. A politician's uttering rhetoric, it's quote, merely rhetoric, that they're just saying something to advance their own interests. What else? Anything else that you think of? Does anybody come to mind? Any ancients or anything like that? No, like Aristotle or St. Augustine or Plato or any of those. Yeah. What a lot of people don't realize is that rhetoric, as it was originally defined and taught, was the art of persuasion. That is, if you look up the word rhetoric, somewhere along the road you're going to find that it's called the art of persuasion. And it goes back to the ancients. As a matter of fact, there were ancient schools of rhetoric. Very particular schools. There was a Hebrew school of rhetoric. Jews had their own school of rhetoric. We don't know about that today because we stopped teaching rhetoric around the end of 1800s or so. Stopped being taught in universities as a part of the ordinary curriculum. There was a Greek school of rhetoric. Literally a school. You would go to that school and you would attend to learning rhetoric. You'd learn how to persuade. Yes, please. Yes. Yes. Yeah, it is considered a negative thing if you think about it in terms of merely political rhetoric or merely some other form of rhetoric. And I'm going to give you three different forms of rhetoric. And they're important to know because as we go through what we're going to be talking about today, you'll need to understand what we're saying when we're talking about rhetoric. Yes, please.
Wasn't it St. Augustine or one of those guys who was actually trained in rhetoric?
Yes.
All of them
were.
All of them did.
The Apostle Paul was trained in rhetoric. If you became a rabbi and you were trained in the Hebrew scriptures and you were one of the peripatetic speakers, you know, people who walk around and talk to students, you were trained in a school of rhetoric. As a matter of fact, if you look at the scriptures as the way they're written today and we look at them, there's one important thing you need to realize about them, and that is that those scriptures, the book of Matthew, the Gospels, Acts, all of those, were never, ever, ever intended to be read alone. We look at the Bible and we think, well, I'm going to have my private Bible study. That was not how the Bible was constructed. It was not constructed because let's go back to the ancient cultures. What were ancient cultures primarily, what was their primary form of communication?
Oral.
O-R-A-L. Not A-U-R-A-L. So their oral traditions, their oral form of communication was the primary way that they transmitted information, which was why rhetoric was so important. Now, I made a mention about why does this matter to the scriptures. Think about this, that when scriptures were written, They ordinarily were written either by the author or more likely by a scribe, somebody who helped. Sometimes they call it an amanuensis, somebody who writes for another. And the reason there might be an amanuensis or somebody who writes for another is that you had to be skilled in writing. And one of the things that, if you look at
now,
the...
When you say writing, Mark, are you talking about the actual process of the writing or composing?
The hand technical skill of putting letters to papyrus. Thank you. So the question was, when we talk about writing, are we talking about mental composition, as we would think about a writer being a writer today, or about the actual script? And we're talking about the script. So imagine you have this problem that you want to convey your message to a large number of people. Well, they didn't have the internet then, so they couldn't do it that way. How did they do it? So they did it by speech. So if I'm Matthew and I want to propagate the gospel of Matthew, I want to tell people what I saw as Matthew and what I heard other people tell me, I had to write it down. I would, or have somebody else write it down. I would hand it to somebody. That person would be the reader or the speaker, depending on how you want to call it. And that person would be my emissary and would go out and would not merely read what they wrote. And this is extremely important to get here. They did not merely read what they wrote. They presented it. It was a presentation. It was a drama. It was a recitation with the same kind of intonations and emotional effects that came from the original speaker. So the person who was presenting it, if they were the writer, had to not only have to be able to write quickly, but they had to do it in a way that they could recall when they were going to go out and be the ambassador. And if you look in the book of Revelation, it even talks about that. It talks about, blessed is the one who reads and speaks this. That's part of the culture. It's referring to the process of going out to the different churches and handing the document to a reader who will go out and who will express with all the emotional impact and all of the persuasiveness, the rhetoric of the original author. Now, you can see a little bit of the artifacts of this when you look at ancient scrolls, and particularly in the Greek, it's very easy to spot. How many periods, commas, question marks, chapter divisions, or even line numbers do you see on any of those ancient papyri?
Not too many.
None. You don't find them. It's rare to even see spacing. What you just see is if you wrote something and you wrote it straight across with no spaces, no periods, no commas, nothing.
No capitals,
although there were capital letters. So every once in a while you might get something like that in there.
Why is that?
That was because papyrus was extremely expensive and hard to come by. Ink was expensive and hard to come by. And scribes were expensive and hard to come by. So you had it was very costly to produce one of these scrolls. You couldn't go down to Kinko's and have, hey, would you pop me out a couple of scrolls for this? Didn't work that way. So to conserve papyrus, ink, the time that it took to write, and because they had one thing that we do not, which is the person who wrote it was usually the person who would perform it. So they would hear it, they would recite it back to the person that they were writing for, they would present it, and then they would go out and they would be the ones who were sort of the YouTube of their time. You know, except they would go out and they would do the performance themselves. And so they didn't have to have all sorts of interesting divisions and things like that because they knew exactly what it said. They had heard it, and now they're uttering it afresh. Now, what does this have to do with science? What does it have to do with science? Well, I will have to tell you that in a couple of minutes. The reason that I bring this up, though, is so that you'll recognize that when we talk about rhetoric, and evangelism in the same breath, that this goes back a long, long time. From the very inception of the scriptures of our Bible, rhetoric was taught, was practiced, and was the medium, the conceptual medium through which the scriptures were propagated. This is extremely important because when we look at the scriptures, we're looking at chapters and verses and little subdivisions, etc., that are artificially imposed on that by somebody other than the author. And we have to be careful of that because when these were originally spoken and transmitted, they got the whole thing at one time. So imagine you're sitting down and you're in a house church and the person who's going to be doing the reading is going to read it to you. There probably weren't intermissions. There probably were just start from Matthew 1 and end at the end. Pardon me?
No chapters.
Just go. It was just start and finish. Yeah. And so they would go and go and go. And so it was, what it was a performance and a carriage of the original information faithfully written. Now I mentioned that I was going to talk to you about the different kinds of rhetoric. And what's the reason that that's important is that I will have some scriptures for you that are in fact rhetorical and very interesting rhetoric from the Bible. So there are three different kinds of rhetoric. Now if you go to a school and you learn rhetoric, you're going to learn all sorts of different kinds, but there's chiefly three kinds and they relate to time. So the first kind of rhetoric is one that refers to something in the past. And it's usually called the rhetoric of advocacy or forensic rhetoric. So if I were going to be testifying in court or I were going to be a lawyer, I would be talking about something that happened in the past. And I would be trying to persuade you that the event I'm claiming occurred as I told you it occurred. So that's the rhetoric of the past. I'm trying to persuade you of something that happened. And then there's another kind of rhetoric where I'm trying to persuade you of a concept of the present or something that's timeless. So for example, if I'm trying to convince you that the earth is round, okay, that's of the present. That's a concept that endures before and after I speak it. So I'm not trying to convince you of something in the future or the past. This is something that is here and now. And then there's the persuasion of the future where I'm trying to persuade you to do or become something in the future. To do or become something in the future, or to look at the future in a particular way. So, for example, if I want to persuade you to believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that's a future-oriented persuasion. I want you to understand this and then to change as a result of that. So, think of those kinds of different rhetorics, forms of rhetoric, and recognize that there are adjustments and different variations on those themes. But that's kind of what we're talking about when we talk about rhetoric.
Mark, what was the second one?
The second one was the current conceptual rhetoric. Okay. The rhetoric of concepts. I want to convince you of a concept. And remember, rhetoric is always a persuasion. It's an act of persuasion. I want you to know something, and it's an art. We could spend all hour just talking about at least the Greek method or the Greek thought of rhetoric, but we're not going to do that. This isn't the rhetoric class. But this is so important, the feature of rhetoric is so important to the argument I'm going to propose today, that you need to have that background. So, where are we going to be going with this? All right, we're going to be covering some questions in the philosophy of science, because science, as it is used today, is used in ways other than just to prove or disprove facts. At least that is the way it comes across. We're going to talk about the background of science, what some of its limitations are, and then some things to remember about science, because Hugh Ross's class is ultimately, and Hugh Ross's foundational ministry is ultimately, to reach out to scientists and to people who are concerned about science. And to do what with them? To persuade them, yes. To persuade them of what? The truth of the Bible, yes. And God, yes. among other things, but those are the fundamental things that he's trying to do. And so in that heart, that spirit, that's what we're going to be doing here today, to understand how do we go about that. And to do that, we need to know a little bit about some of the presumptions of science, what the philosophy of science is, and how it's distinguished from science itself. So what are we talking about when we talk about the philosophy of science? What are some of the things that the philosophy of science does that science does not? Yes, sir. So there's a philosophical aspect to that kind of naturalism, the methodological naturalism. In other words, they're looking for naturalistic explanations from naturalistic phenomena, correct?
And which are all post-creation, of course.
Yes. Thank you. That's true. And one of the things that philosophy of science is doing, I should say one of the objects of study of philosophy of science, is what counts as science. Now again, if we were going to spend the time to try to define science, we would not get it done today, if we spent 24 hours. How many of you believe that there is a completely agreed upon definition of science? I'm glad nobody raised his or her hand, because there isn't one. And that's one of the things that a lot of people don't realize, is that philosophers of science have been struggling with the question, what is a definition of science that everybody will accept and that everybody will be able to apply? And they haven't come up with one. Scientists haven't come up with one either, but that's because it's not a scientific problem. It's a philosophical problem. See, it's not a scientific problem because there's no way to test it. How would I do an experiment on it? The philosophical question. It's something that requires discourse and values. So what counts as science is an important question. And there isn't any answer to it. So when I use the term science now, I'm going to have to be vague, which I hate doing, and it's a violation of my trust as a philosopher. I'm fired right up front. But what we'll do is we'll operate on a naive definition of science as just being science being that process that human beings involve themselves with as an enterprise where they attempt to find natural phenomena and understand the natural world. And there's a lot more that could be added to that. I've seen paragraph-long definitions that still were inadequate, but I need to be just enough so that we understand I'm not talking about weird science or pseudoscience. I'm talking about the things that most of us in here would recognize immediately to be science. So that is one of the struggles that the philosophy of science has to deal with, is what counts as science? Another one that you would ask, you probably never thought of, is how is it that theories explain? What do we mean by an explanation? You know, only philosophers can come up with these weird questions. Scientists don't worry about that stuff. No, they don't care. This is, well, I've got a theory. What does that mean? Well, it means I got a theory. But what is a theory? How does it go about explaining? How do you justify that particular explanation? These are philosophical questions, not scientific questions. Yes, please.
I feel like I work in a lab, so I feel like a lot of the people I work with, you know, we're quite content having a mechanistic theory or explanation for a very kind of circumscribed process.
Yes.
But then I do find that the people in my lab, if I ask them a broader question, like you guys were talking about, sometimes there's an assumption that naturalism is just, well, of course we're fitting this into naturalism, but you're right. People don't always go to that other level. People are very much thinking about, well, how does X work? And not always going beyond that.
Yes, thank you. And it makes sense that they would be doing that. If scientists weren't doing that, what would they be doing? They wouldn't be doing science, that's for sure. They have to operate from at least the starting point of mechanistic explanation. And we're going to talk about some of the assumptions and presumptions of science in a couple of minutes. But you're exactly right. It's a curious thing that at once the scientist must do exactly as you say. And on the other hand, they should be doing more. Thank you.
That's where the money is. You know, you have to follow the recipe to get results.
That's right. And I'm very happy that that recipe exists. Because if it didn't, we wouldn't have the scientific advances we have today. But we have to go one step further, which is why we have to remember that we have a rhetorical enterprise before us. A rhetorical enterprise. We have some persuading to do. But before we can persuade, one of the aspects of rhetoric is to understand what the content of the argument's going to be and what the content of the argument against us will be. Or I shouldn't say even against us, against the argument we're proposing. Because I really don't want to make it me versus you. I want to make it this argument versus that argument, and let's talk about these two ideas. Why make it personal when you don't have to? Although this Friday, at our Reasons to Believe chapter meeting, which is 7 to 9 p.m. in this room, upcoming Friday, we're going to be looking at an old video, it's a 2008 debate between Victor Stenger, an atheist physicist slash astronomer, and Hugh Ross. Now, why would I bring up a video that's almost 10 years old and use that? Number one, the arguments that are posed in it are still current today. And number two, you get to see how rhetoric operates there, particularly with the atheist. But it's interesting to see how Hugh Ross does his rhetoric. And so not only do we learn what the arguments are, but we get to see how people practice from different perspectives. You see Hugh Ross's gracious way of doing business, and you see Victor Stenger's not so gracious way. So I won't say anything more about that. If you want to come and see, come and see. How do we justify that a claim that a theory has been confirmed? Again, that's another one of the questions of the philosophy of science. When we say, that theory has been confirmed, we've confirmed Einstein's theory of general relativity. What are we really saying there? Are we saying that it's inviolable? Are we saying that it's incapable of being changed? Or are we just saying, well, it's all we know for now? Or are we saying, well, we think that's true because the theories that went on before that to make those observations are true, but we really never have thought about these other theories that are based on theories, which have theories that substrate them, and so forth. Very few theories are singular. They're usually a theory that relies on theories below it. So, for example, if I believe in germs, if I believe that germs exist, and I prove that theory by looking under a microscope, are there any other theories involved there? Well, yes, there are. There's theories of optics. That what I'm seeing looking through this eyepiece is actually what's down there below. There are theories of optics that mediate between what I see with my eyes and what I cannot possibly see. And there's other theories that go on as well. Yes, please, you had a question.
Okay. Plus, sometimes what's called a theory is really a hypothesis.
Yes.
They give theory status to hypotheses that really aren't proven.
Thank you. Do you have in your mind a clear distinction between a hypothesis and a theory? Mm-hmm. And what is that in your mind?
Proof. Evidence.
Evidence.
I mean, even Darwin's theory was really his hypothesis. It still is.
Does a hypothesis require some evidence to start?
It requires a question.
And what would be the difference between a hypothesis and a speculation?
They're kind of similar.
Okay.
They don't carry a lot of weight until the evidence comes in.
So is a hypothesis something that we want to test?
Hypothesis is what you want to test.
Okay. And then a theory would be a hypothesis that's been tested?
And it has strong evidence.
Strong evidence.
And a lot of times what they call theories don't.
Thank you.
But a theory is a theory.
But, well,
that's all it is.
Won't argue with that.
But in science, we have more and more higher, which is a law, which has been exhaustively tested and yet raised to a law. And there's some theories, in my opinion, that ought to be law, but for theological reasons, they don't want to.
Yes. So what you're bringing up are more questions in the philosophy of science. What's the difference between a speculation and a hypothesis? The dog knows. He wants in here right now to talk.
I thought it was a squeaky wheel. I
No, he's a little junior rhetorician. So we have speculation, hypothesis, theory, law. We have other things called law-like statements. There's this really interesting zoo of words that we can apply to this. And the reason I want to bring this up is not to turn you into experts or make this strictly a philosophy of science class, although I'd love to do that, but to show you that philosophy of science and science look like the same thing sometimes, but they are not. They are not. They're very different, and you do not need to be a scientist to philosophize about science. And that's one thing you need to be very careful of, is that you do not need to shrink back because the person you're talking to is a scientific expert in a field when you start to talk about the field rather than talk about the actual objects of the field. So I don't know much about astronomy. I mean, I've, you know, read Hugh's books and some other books. I'm not an astronomer. But when an astronomer comes to me and says, well, there's no way that there's a God, I said, oh, that's interesting. Please, do you have any kind of physical test that you've come up with to prove that there is no God? Well, no. Okay, thank you. So now we're talking metaphysics. I'm glad we got it. Now we're getting into metaphysics. Now anybody in this class can talk about that person or talk with that person about metaphysics with the equal facility that an astronomer would. Yes, please.
You know, what they just throw at me is that the burden of proof lies on us because we're saying there's a God. So they keep saying, no, you prove there's a God. We don't have to prove there's no God.
We can't prove there isn't.
Well,
that's what I say.
So
Doug, there,
I want to make sure I restate your statement so that they can hear it on the internet. So your question is, or your claim is, that those who disagree with us hold us to a burden of proof to prove that there is a God, rather than assuming that they have a burden of proof to show there isn't one. Is that what you're saying?
That's what they claim, yeah.
Okay. That would be an interesting subject to get into, because their claim, it's called the rejection of rejoinder. Their claim is that I don't have to prove my point, you have to prove yours. Well, there's a duty to rejoinder on both sides in this argument. It's not always that case, but in this one it is. And simply put, you can say, well, listen, I will posit my best explanation, and then you posit yours. And now let's compare them. Because if you just say, well, I have to prove my point or you have to prove yours, you're missing the real point. The real point is to present all the evidence you can on both sides and to make a decision that's rational and well-founded. Is that correct? Is that what the Lord wants us to do? Yes. Is there a way to do that that is winsome and gracious? Yes, there is. Is there a way to do it that's also rigorous? Yes, there is. Is there a way to do it so that we come in with the character that's proper to do this? Yes, there is. The Bible tells us. And by the way, I just gave you the three elements of rhetoric. Who you are, the content, and the structure. So we won't get into that, but I'm happy I really slipped that one in on you. All right, so the last thing that we're going to talk about in terms of one of the many, many things that philosophy of science discusses is, does science answer questions about the real world? What an interesting question. Is that a trick? Is that a trick question? No, it is not a trick question. It is not a trick question. So what am I saying here? Does science answer questions about the, quote, real world? What do you think?
Yeah.
Hope so.
We hope so. You hope so? Let's start with your idea. If you think yes, or at least tentatively, what do you mean?
Well, the world would be chaos. If there was no way to answer whether something's real or not. Are you real?
Yeah.
I think so.
I hope so.
I hope so.
If I'm a fake, then I'm a hypocrite, too. What were you thinking, Mara?
Just empirical evidence. Again, you just look around, you've got, it's evident, isn't it?
Okay.
I mean, it takes apart, things and goes back to see how they're, made or found or whatever.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Let me ask you a question here about realism and anti-realism. Have you heard those two terms before, realism and anti-realism? Okay, these are terms of art in philosophy of science. In some cases, actually applied in some of the theoretical physics. But what realism is that the observation that you're making is an observation of an event or an object that actually exists and can be shown to exist. That's realism. Scientific realism is presumed. When I look under the microscope, I'm presuming that that thing I'm looking at, that blob down there, really is a cell. That there really is a cell in the world. Now let's step backwards. A month or so ago, we had a gentleman come in here, a quantum physicist, who gave a talk to us at the chapter meeting about quantum physics. And one of the questions that was posed to him was, do the entities of quantum physics actually exist? You can't see them. You can't see the electron. You can't see the force fields. You can't see the gravitational field. You can't see a whole bunch of things.
You can see their behavior.
You can see what you hope is their behavior. What we see are the putative effects of these entities, which may or may not exist, because we cannot see them directly or even indirectly. What we see, what we observe, what we measure, because sometimes we don't even have to see them, we can hear them. Remember when the gravity wave was detected? How was it detected? How was it transmitted to us?
Oh, indirectly.
Sound. It went through a modulator and it changed the gravity waves into sonic waves so we could actually hear it. So that was an observation that wasn't done with the eyes, it was done by your ears. So here's the point, though. When a quantum physicist does her calculations, and then she comes up with a certain chemical formula or some kind of reaction, she never knows whether the entities that she's postulating in her equations really exist. No one has ever seen them. So is that the real world? So when I ask the question, does science answer questions about the real world? How do we know? And even quantum physicists will answer the question, we really don't know about certain entities and certain kinds of forces that we cannot directly measure or see. Yes, sir?
Well, it's all circumstantial evidence in a sense. And doesn't that go back to your part one of forensics?
Yeah.
Where you're looking at for the evidence of those electrons.
Yes.
Whatever those other particles are called.
Yes.
But we trust it.
We do trust it. And we trust it more and more the more we use the formulas, because they tend to work.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, they work so well that we haven't found any errors in them yet. Yeah. I say yet because we don't know what the future will bring, which is a problem that science actually suffers. So when I ask the question, does science answer questions about the real world? Now you know what we're talking about. Realism, that is, what I can see and observe or detect or in some way sense. And anti-realism, which is, I believe the objects are there because the systems that we use to deduce their effects and deduce their existence are so well established and so effective and so reliable that we'll believe they're there even though we can't see them. That's anti-realism. Please, Mara. Mara, you are becoming a rhetorician. This is frightening. You're doing such a great job. Yes, that is very much like what we're doing. You can can you deduce the unseen from the seen? Scientists in physics do it all the time. Doug, please. I will pick up Warren in just a second. Thank you.
Okay. But anyway, getting back to this question, and maybe you don't want to go there, you want to deal with this first, but there's a question, can we trust our senses? I throw that at people that don't believe, too.
Yeah.
But when we believe in God, we can trust our senses because we know that God says it's a real world. But really, we don't know that even we ourselves exist. And that's one of these really out there atheists start, you know, they watch the movie Matrix and they think everything's like that. And, you know, I mean, really, I mean, where are they coming from?
They're coming from something called solipsism, and which is a belief that I'm the only thing that exists, and all that I see is just the imaginations of my mind. But the yes, it is selfish, and it's ridiculous, because you wouldn't be talking to me if you really thought you were the only one there. But the bigger question that you posed initially, or the bigger comment that you posed initially, which was, can we trust our senses, is a question of the philosophy of science. It's also a theological question, and it's one of the things we're going to be talking about momentarily. So thank you for bringing that up. Warren, I apologize, I miss you.
This goes back a few steps, but proving there's a God, usually the person is talking about proof in the sense that it's constrained by naturalism. And of course, you're reaching beyond naturalism with that question, and you're reaching into logic. And but science does this too. When we see a cave drawing, you deduce that it was an intelligent person who that did it, and there's no way to repeat that in an experiment. So I really like where you're going with this, because you're reaching beyond naturalism and materialism in this.
Thank you, because that's where when we're hoping that we will see exactly what you're saying, which is that ultimately when we're trying to reach out to scientists, to people who think scientists are holding all of the keys to truth, not just the keys to truth to certain things, because they definitely are holding the keys to truth to certain things. We can say without too much doubt that physicists probably have the law of gravity figured out, probably. And a whole bunch of other laws that get used all the time in laboratories all over the planet, consistently and reliably, that they have some things figured out, that there are some things that are reliable. They're reliable, now the question is why? Is there some reason beyond physics that explains that? Oh, well, yes, there is. And that's where rhetoric comes in, and knowledge of the Bible and some other things. So thank you. We're going to be getting into exactly what you talked about, Warren. So just the reason I brought this up is I wanted you to see that what science does is deeper than you think. It is not merely just answering questions about objects in the real world, and that you are qualified to ask questions beyond those, to do metaphysics, and that sometimes scientists are doing metaphysics, masquerading as physics. Now, there's a couple of things I'd like to show that I remember doing a talk on this once, and a group of scientists were absolutely aghast at what I said. And I said, the cause and effect inference suffers an affirming the consequent fallacy. Did you know, dear scientists, that most of science is based on a logical fallacy? You should be aghast. So what do we... can't possibly be. Well, I'm playing games with this. But the truth is that there's an interesting logical inference. The technical term is modus ponens. But what it really does is it allows you to deduce from what's called a conditional statement the consequence. So let me show you how this works. So I have my handy-dandy board here, which nobody can see. But I'm going to put... If water is at a certain temperature at sea level, then it will boil. Okay? So if water is at a certain temperature, then it boils. Right? So here I am, I'm looking around, and then look at this water. It's boiling. What do I conclude? It must be at the sea level and at that temperature. That is a defective conclusion. That is a logical fallacy. You cannot deduce the consequent from a conditional expression this way. It doesn't work that way. If I say this, let me do it this way. If T, then B, T, I can deduce B. The logical rule is called modus ponens. Now this, affirming consequent, is a logical fallacy. It is a formal logical fallacy. The laws of logic forbid this. You cannot do that. Yet that is exactly what you do in science. Okay, here's what it is. Okay, well, do you get the logic? Do you understand the logic? Do you understand why this is a fallacy?
Why?
Do you understand it?
No.
All right. So let me give it two different ways of looking at it. Number one, the rules of logic just say it. Okay, so it's axiomatic. Now you can say, well, thanks, Mark. That's really helpful. But I have to say that. No, number two. Let's look at it a different way. It's at this temperature at sea level, then it boils. It boiled. Is there no other condition under which water can boil?
Oh, of course.
Oh, well.
All right, I didn't understand.
All right, so I assert that it's boiling, and now you conclude that it was only tea.
That it's only tea?
Yeah. So,
yeah.
So here's where the fallacy lies, is that many of the conclusions that science draws, it draws exactly this way. Yes, sir.
I think that's an observation. That's not science.
If okay.
It's science, then you can predict the outcome. So what you said, the temperature goes to boiling point.
Uh-huh.
It's an observation. Science is putting and not being.
Well, in science, I'm not quite sure how you're going to distinguish observation from science if the observation is being used to make a deduction. In other words, I'm trying to infer something from my observation. I perform some particular function in order to produce it. I do what I think is a cause to produce what I hope is an effect. Correct?
Yeah. Observation becomes hypothesis, then becomes theory, then becomes science, becomes proven. So you change input, you expect not to be the same consistently.
Correct. Okay, but it is still a theory or observation of science. And that's why I had to be wary about using my term science. I told you up front, I could spend the entire day on a definition of science and no one would be happy with it. No one's going to be happy with my less satisfactory one either. That science is merely an attempt to find natural explanations and understand the natural phenomena in the world. To understand the natural. Now, we're going to do all sorts of ways. There's all sorts of ways of doing it. But one of the ways that scientists do it routinely, it's not the only way, and that's why I put this as a fallacy of science, is that they will posit a cause, posit an effect, test the cause, and find the effect. And when they see the effect in some other situation, what do they deduce? The cause. That's a logical fallacy. Now, when they find that, do they say, well, that's the only possible explanation? Very often, no. That's the whole process of theory generation. So, well, are there other explanations for that same, what we think is a cause?
Yeah.
The answer is, sure, there could be lots of other causes. But just understand that this particular fallacy is the basis for a lot of science. That at a certain point, when you get to what you think are levels of high or super high levels of confirmation, they don't think that this is a fallacy anymore. Well, this is an argument. Global warming is not. Global warming is just a claim that it's getting bigger or hotter or whatever, colder or whatever. I don't even know what it is.
They say 99% of scientists agree that a lot is causing global warming now. Now, it's not just what they're thinking. I think it's a lot more.
Well, I don't quite understand how you're using the term global warming in this context. So in other words, what is the argument? If what, then what? What are the variables?
You're saying that men are producing carbon or whatever, and it's totally solid that whatever carbon emissions that we're doing makes global warming. Now, that's their theory, and they say that's science, that 99% of scientists believe that. Well, that's not the only thing that causes global warming.
Okay, then in that regard, you're right. There is a fallacy there, that there are other things that are causing global warming other than human beings, right. If that's what you're saying.
Yes.
And so if I say, well, human beings exist and drive cars and raise cattle, therefore you're going to have global warming. There's global warming, therefore the cause of global warming are these things.
Right.
That is the fallacy.
Right.
Yes. That doesn't make it wrong. It just means it's fallacious.
That doesn't mean it's not part of it, but it doesn't mean it's the whole thing.
Yes. And hold on, Doug. I don't want to take this any further because I can already see we're going up some rabbit trails. And I'm always scared to introduce logic because it is more complicated. There are some rules in logic, one in particular, that is so counterintuitive, if I told it to you, you would not believe me. You would not.
You
absolutely wouldn't. What is it?
So you ain't talking.
So I ain't talking, no. I had a hard time believing it myself when I was taking logic. I think it was my second or third course in logic, and I was looking at it and said, what? How do you come up with that? And then, so, of course, the professor said, all right, here it is. Now you have to prove this theorem. And, of course, we're all going blind thinking, how are we going to prove this? And we did it, and it's only like a six-step proof. It's really ridiculously elegant. Yeah, I don't want to get into that. You're right. Statistics are for statisticians. Yes, please.
I'm just going to say anecdotally that most graduate students believe this, and that in the lab, like even myself, like I'm vulnerable to overly simplistic thinking. My boss is always saying, Allison, you know, because he's a different type of thinker than me.
Sure.
I like elegant, simple visions, but in the biological sciences, there is a rhetorical opportunity for humility. Because so many grad students come up with a hypothesis, they spend years, and then the data are something else. And I agree with the gentleman over there that there is that process of manipulating T and B and seeing how it works. And I think there is a lot of room for humility here with scientists who are going to acknowledge what their own process looks like.
Yes.
And we're vulnerable to our own logical fallacies, of which I have many.
Well, it's thank you very much. And the gentleman was right about one thing is that this... this process, as I'm describing it here, is simplistic, and that it is more complicated than this, but this does occur. And the reason I brought it up is I want you to know that when scientists allege that they only operate on pure logic, I can tell you right now they do not. And when they try to say they do, I can say the very basis of your whole cause and effect theories is a fallacy. It's a logical fallacy. So you're doing something with it, and you're, despite the fallacy, you're still coming up with tighter and tighter evidence. But by the way, you are suffering a fallacy. So let's get on to the next one before you guys kill me about this logic stuff. Here's the problem. From a contradiction, you can deduce anything. If A is true and not A is true, then anything is true. That is a theorem in logic. And when you work it out, it's sort of like how Hugh Ross talks about if you increase the number of dimensions, you can do more interesting things. Well, that works out in logic. Doesn't work out in the real world, though. Yeah.
About the dual nature of light.
Well, the dual nature of light is not a contradiction. It's
a paradox.
It's a paradox or it's an antinomy. Antinomy, yeah. Yeah. But that's an interesting question. Which we can't get into.
Okay,
I can already see I'm starting to drift off into the twilight zone here. All right, so only what can be empirically measured and tested by science are true and rational. Do you see a problem with that? So the statement that only what can be empirically measured and tested is by science is true and rational. You can't. There's all sorts of things. See, have you heard this before? Yes, you have, many, many times. And you'll see them in arguments that are posed by atheist scientists. They'll say, look, you may go to your church, you may pray, you may have your so-called miracles, but guess what? If it isn't empirically measurable and testable by science, it's not rational and true. That was one of, yeah, David Hume,
right.
That was one of his arguments.
And
it doesn't fly because it's self-refuting.
Yeah.
And why is it self-refuting?
Because you can't come outside and make sure that you're even doing it.
Thank you.
You can't prove that.
You cannot prove that statement scientifically. Give me an empirical measurement or test that will show that to be true. You've just pushed the button. You have just refuted your own statement. It is self-refuting. It is self-refuting. And we need to be able to be competent to say that. To say, you don't get to say that. That's self-refuting. What your statement is self-refuting. It's self-refuting if it's self-refuting in that if it's true, it's false. And if it's false, then it's false. I know this is hurting your head, and I'm not going to dwell on this, but the reason I bring this up is that as we talk about the kinds of things that scientists can say and the things that you have heard and the way that scientists operate, many of those things masquerade as science, and they are philosophical, and in this case, self-refuting. In other words, they're absurd. They cannot use them as legitimate arguments because they're self-defeating. Jim, please.
Another example. All generalizations are false.
There you go. That's another self-refuting statement. So there's lots of these interesting kinds of things. I'm a liar. Okay? If that's true, it's false. If it's false, then it's false. So those kinds of things are self-refuting. So just be wary that merely because you use big words doesn't mean that it suddenly becomes scientifically accurate when it's merely a philosophical rhetorical ploy. Now, yes please, Mara.
But the cause and effect, even though that was a logical fallacy, does happen.
Well, we hope so.
Right.
That is a question of the philosophy of science. Because, and we'll go back to David Hume. David Hume argued, and David Hume goes back to the 1600s, I believe, a Scottish philosopher. And David Hume says, would you please show me the cause and effect relationship? He says, the best you can do is you can show me that A happens and B happens, and that every time A happens, B happens again. But show me somewhere in there that actually, that A caused B. And you'll say, well, obviously it is, because every time I do A, B happens. Okay, show me the cause. Don't show me A and B, show me the cause.
But the cause is always greater than the effect.
Well, that even if that were true, and I don't know what that really means, you know, the cause is greater than the effect. I've heard Hugh say that, and I've heard other people say it, and I've never challenged it because I know that's just part of a bigger argument that they're posing, but I don't know what that means, and I don't know that it's true. So where I'm going here is that cause and effect, one can say cause and effect has an invisible element to it, that we presume and assume that when B follows A, that A caused B, and we're getting back here again. So the cause and effect relationship is tentatively known and believed, but not ever proved. Now, we don't feel that. We don't feel that. I don't throw my pen up and expect it to keep on going. Up. I fully expect that when I throw the pen up, it's going to come back down again. I don't act like I believe cause and effect aren't there.
So
I know they're there.
That's not a good proof for God.
That isn't a good proof for God. At least not the way I'm describing it.
Or that this
all happened. Let me take that back. The cause and effect question can be applied to the argument that God exists. So I misunderstood what you said.
Yes.
Thank you for helping me out there. Yes, ma'am.
I just had a question. It seems as though a lot of the rhetoric that I hear, uses certain words and couches certain phrases and scientific, I would call it, certain words as being so, but really doesn't have anything behind it that is testable or provable. What do you do with things like that?
You ask them to demonstrate the facts. So I heard, I was actually talking with a biologist professor, and he said, well, evolution is just a fact. I said, great. You're going to say evolution, this grand theory, is one fact. Or if you want to be intellectually charitable, I'll say you think it's factual, that everything about it is proved. Is that what you're saying? I said, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. I said, no, actually, you can't say that. And so the first question I ask is, please give me the peer-reviewed journal article in which you have to prove that life originated from non-life and the chemical pathway that it happened. I got nothing out of that. There was no response. Well, we know. Well, you don't know. You don't know. So blurting out this stupid comment that evolution's a fact when the very basis of evolution is unknown is stupid. It just is stupid. Do not do that, Mr. Biologist. All right, so we talked earlier about some of the assumptions of science, and they're really important to know, because without them, science can't operate. But when you look at them, you're going to find something. So what does it say here? Assumptions of science, and then what does it say underneath that? Objects of faith. If you're a scientist, you must have faith that these assumptions are true. Because if you do not, you can't do your science. It'd be irrational. So the laws of physics are constant or consistent everywhere. If you don't believe that, then why would you do any exploration? If you think, well, it's possible that these laws just willy-nilly change depending on where I am. So if I'm on Earth, they work one way. I go to the moon, they work another way. I go to the sun, they work a different way. Gravitation works differently on this star than that star. How would you possibly ever know whether any of your observations could be converted into a law or a law-like statement if you don't believe that they're all consistent? You couldn't. There would be no way to make them coherent, because coherence demands consistency. You cannot have a coherent theory. In other words, a theory can't work if there's nothing consistent in any of the variables or the laws that govern the variables. Yes, please. Say that again, please.
Can young Earth Christians use these arguments to prove their case?
Can the young Earth, persons who are proponents of a young Earth, use these assumptions to prove their case? Is that what your question is?
No,
they can't. Not any more than anybody else could. I mean, what these assumptions do is tell you what you have to have in order to do science. So if one of the problems with the young Earth interpretation is it requires something, for example, like a radical change in the speed of light. This is a problem for them.
Yeah.
This number one is a problem for proponents of a young Earth who believe that the speed of light had to have been radically changed sometime during the history of the universe. Yet everything that we look at says, no, it has not radically changed. It might be some tiny little minute change, but not significant enough to make a difference between a 10,000-year-old universe and a 10-billion-year-old universe. So, first of all, and I'll get with you, Doug, in just a second. I want to get through these.
Can I just have a question?
Okay. So the laws of physics are consistent everywhere. You have to believe that's true or else you can't do science. The natural universe and its laws are orderly. Well, what that means is that when you look at the laws of the universe after you've done all your experimentation, you have to believe that they can be organized in a way that's comprehensible. That's what that means. If you don't believe that, can you do science? No, you can't. If there's no order to any of the laws, then they're not really laws. The third one is the order and consistency of nature are discoverable. Is that not the basis of science? That we fundamentally believe we can discover these laws, that there are real laws, that they are discoverable, and that they're orderly. And then the last one, which is what Doug was mentioning earlier, is that the mind, the human senses, and the mind are reliable.
Not in everybody.
Okay. I have proved that mine isn't reliable by talking about logic. So here's what we have to be careful of, is that these are generalizations. We all know that the mind can trick us, that our senses can deceive us, but generally speaking, ordinarily, if I look out the door and I see green grass and cars, there really is green grass and cars out there, unless I have a good reason to think there isn't. If I did not believe this, I would be irrational. If I did not believe, think of anybody you know who says, nothing I think is right, self-refuting, so nothing I think is right or can be reliable, and my senses are entirely unreliable.
This is a tangent. We don't need to go here today, but if Sean were here, he would bring up this researcher at Irvine, Hoffman, who is an idealist, but I don't think he's a theist. So he would say that evolution has made our senses non-veridical. That's what he says, and he uses an example of like a beetle that tries to mate with a beer bottle. And all of these different optical illusions and illusions we see in other species where they mistake their target for an object. And he says that's because evolution just wanted to get you close to a brown mate, you know, brown
yeah.
And so he says, based on this, we know that it's not veridical. And he goes even farther to talk about the world being consciousness. It's a huge theory. I don't understand it well. Sean understands it a lot better than me. But it's based on scientists saying that your senses are not veridical. It brings up all sorts of other logical issues.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing that up. You know, the question of idealism and realism and the role of the senses doesn't refute what this fundamentally says, because even the gentleman who's positing this relies on his senses to believe that he's reading what other people are writing, that your reading is that your sense of vision and that your mind are capable of reading what he's writing. So even though he could say, well, I'm not quite sure because, you know, the bugs are trying to get sexy with the bottles and stuff, you know, that doesn't mean that that this is false. He, even in that sense, has to do that. So there is a notion of idealism such that the sense perception isn't entirely reliable. As a matter of fact, there are people, philosophers, who argue that and scientists, for that matter, who argue that you never have access to anything outside of what's inside your mind. That your sense organs are mediators of a world that we construct, and that once it gets into our mind does whatever it does, and it just happens to look like what it looks like. You know, it's rather Kantian view. Kant had this sort of structure that we superimpose a structure on a universe that's different from what it actually is, because we can't really know, except to the degree that it mirrors what God created. So we can get into some really interesting stuff. But I appreciate you bringing that up, because even those situations, somewhere along the road, those proponents of those ideas have to rely on their senses and mind to posit them, to believe them, and to act on them.
You believe there was a bug.
That's right. They believe you are listening to them when they talk. They don't believe you're constructing a universe where you just happen to be there. They really believe they're there. So you get to these interesting theories that philosophers come up with, and I've read so many of them. Are you guys out of your mind? You guys. Yes.
And so they can't get into the deepness of what life's all about.
Yeah, and what you and Warren are talking about, you're getting into this question of can you get outside of the box of science into theology or metaphysics? And where I'm going with this is not exactly there, because I really want to talk about how we should evangelize, not just about that argument about methodological naturalism, although that's very important, and it's one of the things we would have to argue about. But where I'm trying to go with this is that if you're going to look at the question of methodological naturalism, you're going to have to do it in a winsome way. That merely telling somebody, yes, you're doing your science in the right way, but But when you hit the boundaries of science, and there are boundaries of science, I've already shown you that some of their assumptions are boundaries. You can't go beyond that. You can't. One of the boundaries is you have to have one of these assumptions of science, and if you don't assume them, then you have hit one of the boundaries of science. You can't do science without some of these assumptions. Then what happens is, when you do that, when you're able to explain to somebody that there is a boundary to science, and that where that boundary lies is yet another set of domains in which you can still talk about truth, now you can start to persuade somebody to listen. Plus, there's another way of looking at it too. That's just one way, one rhetorical way of doing with it. The other way is to say, well, wait a minute, scientist, you're doing exactly the same thing we're doing. You take the evidence and you make a deduction, or you produce some inference. We're doing the same thing. We just have different inferences. And you, by the way, Mr. Scientist, have decided you're going to close the possibilities where we are more open-minded. We are going to open the possibilities, and you can't prove that we're, our possibility of the existence of God is in any way irrational or false.
Reductionism.
Well, it is reductionism in one sense. Mm-hmm. Steve, you've had your hand up, and I have to admire you for being able to do that long. My arm would have gone lame and limp. Well done, thank you, and I apologize. I hope it didn't hurt too much. Thank you. Yeah, I think it would be well, it would do us well to have those kinds of debates, because there are debates on the facts. Those tend not to get contested too much. And when they are, they're typically contested by scientists. You know, someone will say, well, the data say this, and someone else will say, well, the data say that. Most of us in this room, with a few exceptions who are competent scientists in their own right and doing their own work, won't get involved in those kinds of data phrase. But when you start to ask, what do the data suggest? What kind of inferences can we draw from them? And then you step back and say, all right, given these different, for example, the discontinuities, the one I described that I argued about, which was the starting point of life itself. Okay, there's a discontinuity between non-life and life. That's a discontinuity. We don't know how that got there. So the non-theist says, well, there's a natural explanation. The theist says, well, God did it. Okay, well, we're both filling in a gap. So at a certain point, and I'm going to step back here as sort of the viewpoint of the grand philosophy of science, we have to ask ourselves, what do gaps mean? This is a philosophical question. This is actually a question of the philosophy of science. When we look at gaps in knowledge, is there a, a rational reason to reject a theory because it has too many gaps, or the right kind of gaps, or the gaps are growing, its competitor has fewer gaps, what do they mean? So earlier on I talked about what does it mean to explain? What does it mean to confirm a theory? Gaps are part of that problem. So I thank you very much for bringing that up, because it really is important to appreciate that we can look, even as Christians, even at Christians looking at evolution, we can look at the gaps and say, well, do the gaps really say or really mean that evolution is false? That's an open question. And so it's worthy of the kind of discussion that Steve is bringing up. So thank you very much for that. Sure.
We can see change and improvement. And we're in that major shift, I would propose, in the past 10 years now, finally starting to accept it, to where we can argue design. But I'll be more specific. Random mutations stochastically don't make sense. A lot of people are agreeing, like we have for a long time, that they're deleterious. That's great. They've filled it in with actual mechanics of transposable elements that have been known for 50 years, but since Barbara McClintock in the 50s, but finally are coming to fruition. And it shows amazing design. What do they do with that? That's more advanced at this moment.
Sure. Thank you very much. And by the way, A.J. Roberts is working on that kind of stuff.
Right in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. We have 5 minutes left to get 3 hours worth of work done.
Yeah, I have a comment.
It'll be a miracle. Somebody ready for a miracle? Go ahead. Okay. Go ahead.
Now, do you agree with me that this is really good stuff?
Yes.
Okay. I'm learning some stuff, and this is very valuable. I'm a little upset that you chose to teach on a Sunday when lots of people are missing, and I would like to propose, dear, that you continue this. We need a lot more of this, and we need to learn more. We need to get the other people back and do the little review so we're all on the same page, because you've got a lot more you need to teach us.
I think
it is being recorded, so I'll encourage them to listen to it, okay? Because there will be 600 to 1,000 people listening to this recording.
Oh.
Okay.
But thank you very much, and I can tell you this, that I'm not getting through this today. I'm not even going to ask God for that miracle. I don't know how I could talk that fast. I just don't know how I could do it. But to answer your question, why would I do this on a weekend where most people aren't here? And that is because the people who are here are still every bit as valuable as anybody who's not here. So I'm here. You're here. Lord bless us. He gives us what he gives us when we're where we are. Next time, I will go through this very quickly. I won't be able to go this slowly and carefully. But the end of this, which is my point is going to be that it would probably be the most important part. We're learning a lot of neat stuff. I hope some of this is actually interesting to you. But it does have a value in the end when we talk about rhetoric and how rhetoric can be used in evangelism and how it has been used scripturally. Because I have scripture stuff here to talk about. Because that's ultimately why we're here, right? It's about the Lord, not about science. But we do have to talk about science in order to be able to talk with scientists about their presumptions, about their faith, because they do have a faith. And that needs to be shown to them. Look, don't tell me you don't have a faith, brother, because you do. Dear scientist, brother or sister, you have a faith. It's just, what is it in? So let's look at some of the things they do have faith in. They have a faith that mathematics is reliable for scientific inquiry. Now, that's one of the most interesting questions. Even Einstein was perplexed by that. And a lot of other brilliant men and women were. They bang their heads up on the wall and said, why is it that mathematics works? Why do conceptual abstractions work in the real world? And you can say, well, that's just because we design these tools to operate around our theories. That won't work because a lot of the abstract concepts in mathematics were created before anything in science ever could apply it, before they even knew that science could apply it. There's just some guy just hanging out, I want to do some math today, and he comes up with some brilliant stuff, and then it's applicable 380 years later. Had no idea. But it works. Why? We don't know. Scientists believe it works, though. They can't operate if they don't believe that mathematics works. The laws of deductive logic are reliable in scientific inquiry. Of course, this one here is going to be a problem for them unless they really know it well. But the rest of the laws of logic, this law of logic, they're not going to argue with. They're just going to discuss tentativity. That this is tentatively believed or tentatively accepted. And they'll just write off the logical fallacy. But otherwise, the laws of logic, you have to use the laws of logic effectively. Or if you don't use them, then you cannot do science. You cannot, rationally. And lastly, that the ultimate physical constants are brute, inexplicable facts. That's interesting, the word inexplicable, because that means that if we're going to say that the what I call ultimate physical constants, like the constant of gravitation, okay, that's just a brute fact. It's just there. Nobody can say, well, the reason it's this and not that, because there's nothing before it. It is an ultimate physical constant. There's bunches of them. You know, the electromagnetic pulse, all of these, you know, what's the rest mass of an electron? Well, why does it weigh that much? Why does it have that rest mass? If we want to call it weight, that's not the right way to describe it. Why does an electron have the rest mass it has? Nobody knows. You can't know. You can't know. It's just a brute fact. Please.
Well, I have a problem with this brute fact inexplicable.
Good.
There's a law of sufficient reason. And I don't think there's an exception to that law.
We can get into that next time. Because what I'm doing here is not disputing what you're saying. I actually agree with you. But in order to practice physics, you must believe that the constants are brute, inexplicable facts to start with. In other words,
sure. You're operating within a certain realm.
Yes. They do believe that. If they didn't believe it, they wouldn't ever say that these particular constants are reliable. So with that, let me see what we got in this next one here. Okay, I'm not going to show you the 3 points to remember because then you won't come back. You won't remember. That's right. That's a fallacy. It would just be destructive to your logic.
Can we close?
We are going to close right now, Steve. Thank you very much. You're absolutely right on the money in terms of time, too. So let me do this, friends. I don't know when the next time when Hugh Ross is going to be gone, but I will take that time. I'll go through this very quickly, and then we'll get to the end, which is what everybody wants to be for here anyway. So meanwhile, let me pray and release us and say, Lord, thank you. Thank you so much for giving us minds and for giving us spirits and for giving us souls. Lord, there is nothing in the universe more precious to you than the soul of every human being that's ever lived and ever will live. And may we remember, Lord, that we are here to make disciples of those who come to you and to help to bring those to you who have not yet come to you. May we be persuasive and comely and gracious and just like you, Jesus. Amen. Thank you all very much.